All right, this evening the plan is to finish up the last 18 or 19 verses here in Leviticus 25. We are coming to the end of the study in Leviticus, a very important chapter coming in next time, Leviticus 26, and then some additional laws in Leviticus 27, and then that will be it. We are obviously working our way through this entire book of Leviticus. If you remember, the book of Leviticus answers the question, how can a holy God live in the midst of a sinful people? And in order for that to be the case, you need three things. You need a holy house, which we saw was the tabernacle in the latter portion of the book of Exodus. You need sacrifices to cover the sins of the people, and we saw that in the early portions of Leviticus, and then you need that people to live in holiness. And so that's where we have been for the last few sessions in the book of Leviticus, is learning along with the Israelites what it means to live a life of holiness under the old covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the covenant that God made at Sinai with his people. And so last time we were together, we were in the first portion of Leviticus 25, and we talked about the Sabbath year, which was every 7 years, and then we talked about the Jubilee year, which is the 50th year, right? After seven Sabbaths, then you would have a special year, which was the Jubilee year, where debts would be forgiven and slaves would be freed. And so tonight, we're going to finish up Leviticus chapter 25, talking about slavery. And this is actually the third time that I have talked about slavery at Abiding Grace Church. And so before we begin, I just want to commend to you the two previous times that I addressed this particular topic, and they will be in the notes on sermon audio. I put the links to the two previous times that I've discussed this issue. So on March 29th, 2015, I preached a message called Slaves and Masters from Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through 9. And you can find that at sermon audio. And in that message, that sermon, I laid a lot of foundational material down for why the Bible, Old Testament and New, does not outright and out of hand simply condemn slavery. And I go into some of the history and talk a little bit about, you know, when we say the word slavery in our current cultural context, it means different things to us than it did in the times of Moses or Paul. So there's a lot of foundational material in that sermon entitled Slaves and Masters from March 29th, 2015. And then back when we were going through Exodus, Exodus 20 through 23, if you remember, is called the Book of the Covenant, which God gave to Moses at Sinai. And almost the entirety of Exodus chapter 21 deals with laws regulating slavery in the context of the Old Testament Israel. And at the end of the day, the arguments that I made in those two messages, the sermon from Ephesians 6 and the discussion from Exodus 21, is I drew a clear distinction between the indentured servanthood of Old Testament Israel and the chattel slavery of 19th century United States, for example. Okay? And I said in no uncertain terms, especially in the sermon from Ephesians chapter 6, that the chattel slavery that was typical, say, of 19th century United States, which ultimately brought on the Civil War, would have been unequivocally prohibited by the Mosaic Law for many reasons, that would have been the case, not the least of which is that things like kidnapping and man-stealing were prohibited under the Mosaic Law, and I'm not going to go into those details tonight, but also if a slave escaped slavery under the Mosaic Law, for example, and went to another person's home, that person whose home that they showed up to was actually prohibited from returning that slave to the original owner. And that clearly was not the case under chattel slavery. And there are multiple other reasons why that kind of chattel slavery is absolutely condemned by God's law, and it ought to be absolutely condemned by Christians like ourselves as well. I'm not going to relay all of that foundation tonight, but I just wanted to give you a heads up that information is out there if you'd like to go and refresh yourself with those messages. What we will see tonight is that the context of what we're talking about in this latter portion of Leviticus 25 is when a person or a family becomes poor. That should be abundantly clear to you as we pick up in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 35. Now, in case a countryman of yours becomes poor, and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, that your countrymen may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And so here, let me begin in verse 38. And I mentioned this when we were in Exodus chapter 21. So much of God's law that he gives to Old Testament Israel is for the purpose of providing a contrast between life in Israel and life either in Canaan or in Egypt. And you can see that here in verse 38. And specifically, as with regard to the Israelites dealing with their countrymen, or in this case, literally in verse 35, brother living in Israel. No Israelite was to take advantage of another Israelite in the same way, for example, that the Egyptians took great advantage of the Israelites, as we read about and studied about in the early portions of Exodus. And so what does that look like? Sort of boots on the ground. So in verse 35, if a countryman or a brother becomes poor, then you are to sustain him. Okay, you are to sustain him. So the Israelites were called upon very clearly to to sustain and provide for their fellow Israelites if those Israelites fell on hard times. Part of that sustaining and providing for is not charging any interest to the Israelite, to other Israelites, if they, for example, borrow money or borrow food. That was definitely prohibited one Israelite to another. You can see that in verses 36 and again in verse 37. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. So the Israelites were called upon to be generous and gracious to one another, providing gifts at most, and at the very least, if a person wanted to be remunerated for the silver or for the food that was provided, they were not to charge interest if the repayment was delayed. Okay? Now, verse 39, and if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave's service. He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner with you, until the year of Jubilee. He shall then go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family, that he may return to the property of his forefathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land, out from the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold in a slave sale. You shall not rule over him with severity, but are to revere your God. All right, so here is a slightly different situation, a more serious situation, where an Israelite comes and is so poor, has fallen on such hard times, that he sells himself to another Israelite. Okay, and again, this may be due to multiple things. It could be due to a blight on that person's farmland, right, where there's no crops, and so no ability to sustain himself in a primarily agrarian culture. It could be debt that is built up that does need to be paid off. There are a few different ways that this might happen. But in this particular case, the Israelite becomes so poor that he sells himself to another Israelite. And in this particular case, the Israelites are again commanded to be gracious to their fellow countrymen. Okay? And he is only to be enslaved by a fellow Israelite until the year of Jubilee, whether or not the entire debt has been paid. Okay, this is very important as we get into verses 44 through 46. So when one Israelite sells himself into slave labor to another Israelite, at the year of Jubilee, that slave is to be released, set free to go back to the property of his forefathers, verse 41, regardless of whether or not the debt is completely paid off. And again, what we see in this is we see God commanding his people to provide for, to care for, and to sustain their brothers and sisters in Israel. And I also want to note here, one thing we see is that in many cultures that were not regulated by Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, it was very common for the head of a household, if he were to owe a debt, to sell one of his children into slavery. Okay? Very, very common in the history of the world. You don't have to look very far in an Encyclopedia Britannica to find that this is the rule, not the exception. And one of the aspects of the righteousness of God's law is that that is not the case in Israel. It should be clear to you, once I point it out at least, that a man who has fallen on hard times and needs to repay a debt, he sells himself into slavery of another Israelite. Now, that may mean that his sons and his wife and his daughter come with him, but he does not unilaterally send other members of his family into slavery while he himself remains free. No, the head of the household who owes the debt takes on the primary responsibility of working that debt off until the year of Jubilee. And as I pointed out in Exodus 21 some time ago, that was on October 2nd, 2019, that we do see a great deal of righteousness and even grace in the way that the Mosaic Law given by Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, deals with these situations where Israelites become slaves or enslave themselves to another Israelite. And so we declare this law to be immensely righteous. Verse 43, you shall not rule over him, that is your countrymen, with severity, but you are to revere your God. And why is that? Look at verse 42. For they, the Israelites, who sell themselves as slaves to repay a debt, they are my servants whom I brought out from the land of Egypt. So when one Israelite sells himself into the service or enslavement of another Israelite, that second Israelite is to remember that that first Israelite is not his servant. That first Israelite is God's servant, first and foremost. And that should regulate the way the Israelites treat and rule over one another. All right, verses 44 45 and 46. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may acquire male and female slaves from the pagan nations that are around you. Then, too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition, and out of their families who are with you, whom they will have produced in your land. They also may become your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you, to receive as a possession. You can use them as permanent slaves, but in respect to your countrymen, the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another. And so what we see here in verses 44 through 46, which quite frankly I deem to be about as controversial a set of verses as we might find here in the Pentateuch, right? Because it certainly looks like that Israelites are given permission by Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, to take on pagans as perpetual slaves. And so let me just walk through this here. So there will clearly be sojourners in Israel. They will choose not to become Israelites. Okay, now, just as a reminder, any non-Israelite could come into Israel and could join himself and his household to the nation Israel. And the way that a non-Israelite became a member of the nation of Israel was that he and all of the males of his household would become circumcised. And so they would become Israelites. There were some people who, it was anticipated, once the Israelites went into the land of Canaan and took over the land of Canaan as promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, that there would be some people who came into Israel who chose willingly not to join themselves to the nation Israel. These would be sojourners or aliens. Okay? And in this particular case, what you might have is a sojourner who's living in Israel who also falls upon hard times. And I actually mentioned the sojourners last time in Leviticus chapter 25, talking about dwelling houses in walled cities. So that's Leviticus 25, 29, and following. So you have these sojourners, these pagans who would come in to Israel and would not join themselves to Israel. Nonetheless, they would live in a walled city, for example, and they would take advantage of the marketplace, and or perhaps they were just passing through or whatever. And perhaps while they were living in Israel as a sojourner, they also would fall on hard times, and that they would owe someone a debt that they could not repay. In this particular case, the Israelites here in verses 44, 45, and 46 were given permission to take these sojourners on as slaves as well, in exactly the same way that they would take on an Israelite brother. There is one stipulation, however, that is different. And I want you to see that. So let's read them again and understand what the context is. These are sojourners, non-Israelites, who are taken on as slaves by an Israelite for the purpose of paying off a debt, because that's the larger context that we're talking about here in verses 35 and following. Verse 44. As for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may acquire male and female slaves from the pagan nations that are around you. Then, too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition, and out of their families who are with you, whom they will have produced in your land. They also may become your possession. You may even bequeath them to your sons after you to receive as a possession. You can use them as permanent slaves, but in respect to your countrymen, the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another. And so we see that there is one contrast here for how the Israelites are to deal with Israelites who enslave themselves versus those from the pagan nations or the sojourners who enslave themselves. And that difference is that in the year of Jubilee, the Israelites are not required to set the sojourner free and forgive his debt. There is clearly a distinction being drawn between the Israelites who benefit from the Jubilee year and the sojourners who do not. And so a couple things in verse 46 I want you to see. The first thing I want you to see is the last portion of verse 46, when it says, "But in respect to your countrymen, the sons of Israel, you shall not rule with severity over one another." Usually when we talk about severity, what we have in our minds are things like beatings and other things. That is not what's being talked about here. Because the Mosaic Law, over and over and over again, commands masters of slaves to deal with their slaves righteously. Okay? The severity here is that the severity that's being addressed here in verse 46 is simply that the sojourners are not to be released in the Jubilee year. The Israelites are. That is the severity that's being discussed there. The second thing I want you to see in verse 46 is I want you to look at the word permanent. Permanent. Okay, I assume that's the word you have in front of you, but basically it's the adjective that describes the word slaves right there in the middle of the verse. Okay, now it is true that that word, which is olam, it's 5769 in the Hebrew dictionary, biblical dictionary. It is most often translated in the Old Testament as something like eternal or permanent or perpetual. Okay, it's used hundreds of times in the Old Testament. And most of the time, it means permanent or perpetual or eternal. In this particular case, however, it does not mean that. It means a long time. A long time. So let me give you a couple of reasons why I believe that to be the case, and why I believe that what's not being taught here is that these sojourner slaves are never allowed to be released. I don't believe that's what it's teaching. Okay? So for example, in Exodus chapter 40, verse 15, the Aaronic priesthood, or the priesthood of Aaron, is called a perpetual priesthood. Same Hebrew word. Okay? But we know, as recipients of the New Covenant, that Aaron's priesthood did not last forever. And why is that? Well, it did not last forever because it was superseded by the Melchizedekian priesthood of Jesus Christ. Okay? So the Aaronic priesthood, yes, it was perpetual. It is usually what most translations say. It lasted as long as the Mosaic Covenant lasted. And when the Mosaic Covenant was over, the priesthood of Aaron gave way to the priesthood of Jesus Christ. So it was perpetual or permanent as long as the Mosaic Covenant was in effect. When the Mosaic Covenant was over, Aaron's priesthood was also over. The other thing that I would point out is that there's a version of the Old Testament that is called the Jewish Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M, the Jewish Targum. And basically, it is the Old Testament in the Aramaic language. Okay, the Old Testament in the Aramaic language. And for example, when you look in Exodus 21, verse 6, and obviously I've mentioned Exodus 21 multiple times this evening, when you look in Exodus 21, verse 6, in the New American Standard Version, Exodus 21:6 uses the word permanent. So, for example, if I go back to Exodus 21:6, talking about the priesthood again. I'm sorry, a slave. It's talking about slavery. Talking about buying a Hebrew slave, Exodus 21. And I'll read in verse 5. "But if the slave plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man,' verse 6, then his master shall bring him to God, then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently." That's the same Hebrew word as we're discussing in Leviticus 25:46. What's interesting about that, though, is that in the Jewish Targum, the Aramaic version of the Old Testament, it doesn't say permanently. It says until the Jubilee. And so what this tells us is that in the Jewish tradition, even the slave whose ear had been pierced with an awl, which we read as a permanent slave, in the Jewish tradition, they understood that to mean that that man was a slave only until the Jubilee. So he was not released in the Sabbath year, but he had to wait to a Jubilee year. Okay? And so we can see here that in Leviticus 25:46, okay, this is not a sojourner pagan who sells himself into slavery to an Israelite and can never, ever, ever, ever perpetually be freed. What this means is that this slave will stay in the possession of the Israelite family until the debt is paid off. And when the debt is paid off, that sojourner pagan who sold himself into slavery to an Israelite family will then be freed. So this is not a permanent possession of people. Again, there's clearly a distinction between the Israelites and the pagans. The Israelites were freed in the Jubilee year, regardless if they had paid their debt off or not. The pagan sojourner had to stay as a slave to that family until the debt was fully paid. And that is the severity that's being referred to in verse 46. I hope that is helpful for you to understand. All right, let's finish off Leviticus 25, verse 47. Now, if the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you becomes sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. He then, with his purchaser, shall calculate from the year when he sold himself to him up to the year of Jubilee. And the price of his sale shall correspond to the number of years. It is like the days of a hired man that he shall be with him. If there are still many years, he shall refund part of his purchase price in proportion to them for his own redemption. And if few years remain until the year of Jubilee, he shall so calculate with him. In proportion to his years, he is to refund the amount for his redemption. Like a man hired year by year, he shall be with him. He shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. Even if he is not redeemed by these means, he shall still go out in the year of Jubilee, he and his sons with him. Verse 55, for the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants whom I brought out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And so, basically, what all this means is that if an Israelite sells himself into slavery to another Israelite, or, God forbid, into the possession of a sojourner, as long as that Israelite or that sojourner is living in Israel, then that Israelite who sold himself shall go free in the year of Jubilee. And then it also may be the case that he may redeem himself if he comes upon the funds, let's say through an inheritance, or he may be redeemed by a brother or some other next of kin. And the reason why it's mentioned here, verse 53, like a man hired year by year, he shall be with him. He shall not rule over him with severity in your sight. What this means, the severity again that's being talked about here, is that if a redeemer comes and wants to redeem an Israelite out of slavery, then that Israelite who owns the slave is obligated by God's law to receive that price and allow the Israelite to go free. He is not to be enslaved until the year of Jubilee if someone is able to offer the redemption price. And of course, that redemption price will change depending on how many years that the man and or his family has been enslaved, and also how many years remain until the year of Jubilee. And this is all in the context of not treating Israelites with severity. And again, I would mention at this point that the primary reason why the Israelites are not to be treated severely is because even if they sell themselves into slavery, they have fallen on difficult times, they have become poor. Ultimately, the Israelites are Yahweh's servants, whom He redeemed out of Egypt. A slave does not primarily belong to his master, but an Israelite slave primarily belongs to God. Last comment, and I want to go back to verse 46, because like so many things we have discussed in our study of Genesis, Exodus, and now Leviticus, it's very important for us to see and understand the spiritual ramifications in God's law. And there is a spiritual ramification associated with Leviticus chapter 5, verse 46. And that spiritual ramification is seen in the contrast between the Israelites and the pagan sojourners. This ultimately is a type or a shadow even of the salvation that we have in Jesus Christ. We have said it before many times at Abiding Grace Church, and I am sure we will say it many times again at Abiding Grace Church, is that under the terms of the New Covenant, the Church of Jesus Christ is the true Israel, is the Israel of God, according to Galatians chapter 6. So when you see the distinction between the Israelites and the pagan sojourners, and that distinction in Leviticus 25:46 is this, that in the year of Jubilee, the Israelite debt is to be canceled, and the Israelite is to be set free. The pagan sojourner's debt is not canceled in the year of Jubilee, and the pagan sojourner is not set free in the year of Jubilee. And we can directly translate this into the New Covenant. The salvation that we have in and through the finished work of Jesus Christ sets the true Israelite, those who by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone are saved, sets the true Israelite free and forgives our sin debt. Those who are not of true Israel, they must continue on permanently until their sin debt is settled. And so even in this law, this chapter, even arguably controversial chapter about slavery, especially in our current cultural context, we can see the glories of the gospel and the liberation, the freedom that we have from our sin debt in the finished work of Jesus Christ, when God draws a clear distinction between His people and the pagan nations who choose not to join themselves to Him.